Awesome to welcome Baylor University head coach Nikki Collin to the basketball podcast. Coach Collin has built an impressive coaching career across both the WNBA and NCAA, establishing herself as a dynamic leader in women's basketball. Currently serving as the head coach at Baylor University, Collin has guided the program with a strong tactical approach, compiling a 102 and 36 record in her tenure. Under her leadership, Baylor secured a Big 12 regular season championship in 2022, continuing the program's tradition of excellence. Before transitioning to the college ranks, Collin made her mark in the WNBA, serving as the head coach of the Atlanta Dream from 2018 to 2020. In her first season, she led the Dream to a 23-11 record, earning WNBA Coach of the Year honors in 2018. Collin's coaching journey began as an assistant coach at Colorado State, Ball State, Louisville, Arkansas, and Florida Gulf Coast. She then transitioned to the WNBA's Connecticut Sun as an assistant coach.
Hey, coach, a brief interruption of our podcast. You know, the best player development is coaching development. So let's work together to get your entire basketball organization or program unparalleled expertise and access to basketball immersions group memberships. It's affordable and your players will thank you. Contact us today, basketballimmersion.com contact page, or DM us on X or Instagram. Get your coaches full access to our extensive coaching video library, detailed courses, and modern evidence-based coaching ideas. You can have proven coach development at your fingertips for all of your coaches. Elevate your coaches, elevate your teams. Get started now. Basketball Immersion Group membership is where innovation meets excellence. Contact us today at basketballimmersion.com contact page, or DM us on X or Instagram. Now back to the podcast.
Coach Collin, welcome back to the basketball podcast.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
2019, I can't believe it, but you were in the WNBA there, now at Baylor and doing great things. And we're going to have a great conversation about so many things. But maybe first, just share with us a little bit the perspective of transitioning from the pro game to the college game.
Yeah, it's big and it's open. I think that a lot of people were asking me, like, was that always in the plan? I'm not actually a planner like that. I think I've really always tried to be where my feet are and enjoy where I'm at. And certainly felt like the 2021 season could be a good one for the Dream. We were in training camp when Coach Mulkey left to go to LSU. And I had actually had a conversation probably a couple months previous to that with LaChina Robinson. And we were talking basketball. And she's, you need to be back teaching in the college game. And I'm like, no, I think my next stop is the NBA. Like, I really believed if there was a pathway, what was I thinking? 5 year, 10 year. I'd spent a lot of time with LP and the Hawks and just around the men's, the NBA had been in their coaches' meetings and just really thought, okay, this is what I want to do someday. When my kids are grown and I can handle an 80 game schedule, this is where I think I want to be. And it was just divine intervention, something like that. Baylor called, I listened. And it felt like the right place at the right time. I felt like I could make a difference here. I think I had no idea what the weight of expectation. I think as coaches, we always think our own internal expectations are going to far outweigh the external pressure of what we do. But I will say, I don't think anyone can be ready for really following a Hall of Fame coach and a program that had three national champions. Championships and but I've loved being back. I do enjoy the mentorship piece of college athletics. I like the development piece. I love seeing young women grow up. I like watching graduation. Like, there were pieces of the pro lifestyle that I always found difficult. The season would end, we'd have exit meetings, and they'd be off to their next venture, like usually within 48 hours, and you wouldn't see them. So it was very abrupt. When this is different, the season ends, it's hard, but then you start working out with them 2 weeks later and you start planning for the future and you're helping them with what's next. It's been a good transition to Baylor for sure.
Great to hear you talk about all that because it sets up some of the things we're going to talk about, which I think can help coaches. And that's talking a little bit about the differences between the WNBA, the NBA, and college and pro and college and the closeness of the college game to the pro game now, but all the different things that connect it. And maybe first, let's start with managing diverse personalities. You've certainly had your share over your coaching career. So talk to us about some of those experiences and maybe some of the insights for coaches.
Yeah, I think for me, I probably have a bit of a reputation, and I say this in the most positive way, of being able to work well with misunderstood players. I like to use that term because I think a lot of times, if you don't really get to know somebody, I'll use Tiffany Hayes as a perfect example of that. When I was an opposing coach in the WNBA, watching Tiff and seeing her get technicals, and I just thought, wow, when I took the Atlanta job, that was going to be my biggest challenge, was handling Tiffany Hayes. It took me two practices to really appreciate her and think, wow, if I could have a team full of Tiffany Hayes, uber passionate about the game, uber passionate about her teammates, but just like finding that emotional maturity in how to handle adverse situations in games. Most of the time, she was advocating for a teammate and not herself in a lot of those technical situations. And so getting her to believe in me that I would have her back, that let me get the technical. We don't need you missing a game come 20 games in or 25 games in because your emotions get the best of you. And I think that league is so much about, as much as we don't think about the pro game as relational, we think of it as very transactional, what works under the cap, who fits, all of those things. The reality is you still have to get five people playing with great synergy, and you have to have people buy into their roles and be able to help you off the bench. And so a lot of it is managing personalities, and it's managing expectations and aligning those things and having them feel like they can talk to you. I consider myself a player's coach, and that can be a lot of different things, but I needed my coaches when I played to listen to me. And I think probably at times I came across as thinking I knew more than I did. And so understanding how to have those conversations and have them the right way. I'll never forget one of my true welcome to pro basketball. I was coaching the Connecticut Sun and I coached the defense. I had Alyssa Thomas, who was one of the elite defenders in the WNBA, but also a very strong personality. And you need AT if you're going to have your team. And we were playing the Phoenix Mercury. We had beaten them 2.5 weeks, I think, before that. And so we're going over film from that game. And I said, we're gonna go on the practice floor and we're gonna work on doubling the low post. And AT, in a very challenging way in that film session in front of her teammates, said, we didn't double her the last time and we beat them. Like, why are we doubling? And I explained to her, never wanting to be unprepared, gosh, the last time we played them, Griner was averaging between 15 and 20 touches a game on the low block. Over the last 5 games, they're making a concerted effort to get her the ball. And so she's in that 30 to 35. We're not going to double her every time, but we have to give her different looks. And you're going to be great at doubling. Having that conversation with her, understanding I knew what I was doing. I wasn't just throwing a dart at a dartboard and saying, let's do something different this time. It's here's what we're doing and here's why. And getting her to understand it. That's part of getting the pros to buy in. Now, not every player you coach in the pros cares why you're doing what you're doing. Jonquil Jones at that time in her career was 2 years in and was like, hey, if you tell me to double, we're going to double. If you tell me I'm single coverage, just tell me what side I need to be on. And I would guess that she's very different now after an MVP season playing with the Liberty. Like, you grow in your knowledge of the game the longer you're in the pros. But I think it's you have to figure out how to manage your best players. And so I think even in the college game, while you're managing expectation and you don't have players that maybe think they know as much as pro players know, I believe in teaching the game. I believe in getting them to understand the game better and be able to ask good questions. And I always feel like I'm never going to lie to them. I'm never going to tell them a team we play is better than they are. I'm never going to tell them we can win a game if we can't. But I always think I'm going to find a way to win a game. So I don't think I've ever told them we don't have a chance to win a game. So I think that's the personality piece. You have to understand the nature of your team, the nature of their personalities, what they need to be their best all the time.
I love that deep dive. Thank you for that story, which helps to highlight exactly what we're talking about. One thing I want to connect more is this idea of a coach taking a technical. Coaches know this. Fans maybe don't, media maybe don't know it as much, but can you take us through that mentality to be able to take one for the team or take one for a player, so to speak?
Yeah, I think it's all about players today and probably forever, but I think it's them wanting to know you have their back. And I think at times the frustration over, okay, I don't feel like I'm getting the call. I don't feel like I'm getting fair treatment. I don't seeing their head coach stand up for them in those situations goes a long way. And it's certainly easier. I know I have let's just say, the emotional maturity to know when to back off. If you pick up a technical, if you get a warning, okay, I got what I needed. I got what I wanted. Rarely am I going to lose it to the point where I'm uncontrollably acting like a fool. And because of that, like when you have that sense of control, I think it goes a long way with your players. I know that even this year with my team, while I haven't had a technical since I've been back in college, we had a game where we had one of our best players get in a fight and get ejected from the game. Afterwards, my team is overhearing me talk to basically the director of officials on what the next step is. I'm airing my frustrations about it being called to fight. What was she supposed to do? And when your team hears that, it just, they know you're protecting them. And I think that's really important that they trust you. I don't think players have ever needed more attachment, more affirmation, more than they need right now. And I just, gone are the days where when I played, the head coach was someone you respected, maybe revered, maybe even were a little scared of. And your assistant coaches were that outlet to finding out what the coach really wanted from you. It's not like that anymore. It's no different than the parent-child relationship. So many of the parents, at one point, parents never called coaches. Parents weren't involved once players went off to college. And I think now they're so connected. I feel like I'm talking in some way, shape, or form with parents or family members because a player may, it may be as simple as a player's on FaceTime with their mom, like walking down the hallway, and I'm going to say hi. It just, there's this, it's a different time. Kids are being raised differently. And I can say, as a parent of 2 20-year-olds and a 17-year-old, I get it. I'm not raising my kids exactly like my parents raised me. And so being able to develop a lot of your communication skills, you have to adapt with what's going on in the world.
For me, what's interesting about that is something that I know you shared with me before, which is this concept of balancing this transformational goals in a transactional space. And really, for you, the college game is probably more closely aligned with the pro game in some way from that transactional perspective, I imagine now, than when you were first in college. So I'm curious your perspectives on being able to still provide this transformational experience for players.
First of all, I think once you have them, that's what they want. I think it's the transactional piece that's so difficult right now is getting them. And sometimes maybe even keeping them a little bit. But I feel like we've done a good job of when players are here, making them feel like they belong. And I think that's the transformational piece, that Baylor is more than a place that you're going to win basketball games. Baylor's a place you're going to get an education, you're going to develop relationships, you're going to build a network. You're going to, I always say, like, two parents that when I came back to college, as much as winning and losing is so important, and I absolutely understand that my job depends on my ability to win basketball games. And I don't believe there's anyone more competitive than me. I certainly think there are people as competitive as me. So it's not that there's a con that there are consolation prizes or things like that. But I also believe that my true impact is going to be beyond the wins and losses. My impact is, it's going to matter that we have players that learn to communicate better, that grow in our core values of communication and collaboration and competition and all those things. And we're going to live those out. And my true legacy is going to be how many baby showers, how many weddings, how many life events are, am I going to be invited into, and not just at a superficial level. Have I made an impact enough in their life that once they leave here, they don't just want to come back to celebrate their team's wins when it's 5 years or 10 years, or we're celebrating a championship, but we're celebrating life together. And I know a lot of people say that, but that truly is, for me, a big part of why I do what I do. I've always said basketball has given me everything. Like, it has given me a career. I met my spouse. I have three kids. Like, it was my first love. But I also believe, because of that, like, my responsibility is to find ways to give back. And it owes me nothing at this point. And so, how I use that platform, how I use what I've learned about this game to impact people, is really where my legacy is going to be.
Love that. And for us, just as listeners, maybe can you give some practical examples of maybe how you've developed more of these attachments, more of these transformational opportunities with players? Sometimes we have to manufacture them, sometimes they're organic. I get that. So maybe just share some of the practical things that you do within your program.
Yeah, I think a lot of it. I'll tell you one big change we made the minute I got to Baylor was, and listeners will know, everyone online shops these days. So whether it's Amazon or Shein or all these different things that young women, places they shop at, they were always having their packages delivered to the office space and for safety, for all these other reasons. And our managers used to just take their packages down to the locker room. And the first change we implemented when I got to Baylor was you had to come pick up your packages in the office. And it was an opportunity, if for nothing else, was a 10-second touch. And oftentimes once you get them in that space, they become comfortable in that space. You don't come up to the coach's offices just because you got to watch film with someone or because you've gotten in trouble or you missed a class or you name it, but it becomes a place where you want to congregate, where, and it was like, don't come up here and not speak. So it could be just to pop your head in and say, good day type of thing. But it was just a simple way for us to make our office space comfortable. Then when we moved into our new facility, I designed the entire office space around what I call a centralized, like Delta Lounge. Being in the pros before chartering, things have changed a lot in the W since I've been gone, but I spent a lot of time in Delta lounges being an Atlanta Dream person and wanting a place that people could plug in, sit down and watch TV, do homework for staff and players to eat at a high top type of thing. And we've really focused all our spaces around how do we congregate? How do we build camaraderie? How do we make them feel comfortable? Because I think when you start talking about what's transformational, it's the opportunity to get to know people. And it's not when you just call them up because they didn't turn an assignment. Why didn't you turn an assignment? This last year, we had our best GPA in the history of our program for both semesters back to back. So we're not in this midst of an unlimited transfer portal and the ability to not prioritize like the college experience, the academic experience. We still want that for them. I still want players to understand the ball will stop bouncing someday. And hopefully it's a really long time for a lot of our players, but that they're ready, that they've got a degree that matters, that they've learned how to communicate with people. So that's a big deal for us. I think the transformational part is what everyone still wants. It's just really hard with the circles of people that are around them and the opportunities that are in front of them to make money. I also have to understand why wouldn't they want to make money? Why wouldn't they take advantage of this time in sports? And will it look like this forever? Did Pandora's box get open without a plan? Yes, it did. Will the house settlement hopefully corral this and make it work better? Yes, I hope rev share goes a long ways towards not just helping our players in their future, but also getting a rein in on why are we doing what we're doing? Because I think when you see the coaches that are leaving college basketball, they're leaving because of the lack of constraints, the lack of how do I run a program in this day and age where I've got to be recruiting my own team 24/7. And so I think we're at a tipping point. I certainly think in college sports where we have to, all you have to do is pick up the newspaper and read about the CFP and everything going on with the SEC and the Big Ten, and to know that we're at a tipping point in college sports and wanting to see this space thrive because it has meant so much to so many.
It's a fascinating time in college sports. And just to that other part, I was sitting here going, okay, that's really smart to have all their packages delivered to your office, let alone that you obviously take it to the next level and use it as a contact point, which is awesome. I love that. And that's the beauty of this podcast. I know you're a listener and the practical things like that, that coaches can have their mind stimulated about, just awesome. And coach, we got to use your expertise as well. One of the benefits of being a WNBA coach is that there's a lot more special situations traditionally than a full college season. So let's dive into some of the expertise from your X's and O's perspective on special situations. And I don't know maybe where we start. Do you want to start with maybe two for ones and what your philosophy is
Ah,
on?
great place to
Yeah.
start. So some of our rules are tougher on some of the things that you want to take advantage of because we don't always stop under a minute every quarter. Those numbers, those magic numbers that say it's two for one time when you're in the pros. I remember the first summer I got back to Baylor, and I will tell you that first team I had at Baylor was a pro team. That was the beauty of a Queen Egbo, an Alyssa Smith, a Jordan Lewis, Jamie Asbury. Like we had a group of players that were drafted in the first and second round of that next draft. So it didn't feel like I was making much of a change. They were younger, they were less experienced, they didn't understand terminology, but certainly I remember asking the question, and Jordan Lewis, who was transferring in from Alabama, was the only one that knew really what 2-for-1 was or had any understanding of when you would do it, why would you do it. Like, I'm always educating even our tip-off club, which is our booster base. I had someone ask me the question, like, why do you on the last possession just stand there at half court and dribble it and then dribble in and take a bad shot? And trying to get people to understand that the analytics are going to tell you can't get that wrong. Make or miss, the last thing you want to do is if you have the ball in the last possession, the worst you're going to do is zero out. But if you take an early shot, it could be a -2, it could be a -3. So, best case, you're +2, you're +3. Worst case, you're zero. And I think that's frustrating when you do see a player run the clock down and then not ultimately get a great shot off, or a team jump into zone at the last second with 8 seconds to go. And so you, but I think when you talk 2-for-1s, I think it's about your team understanding. I think the beauty of the 2-for-1 in the pros is when players know they're not thinking, they just got to go score. It's amazing how good they are when they're not questioning, should I take this shot? Is it a good shot right now? And so the question becomes then, the unique part about 2-for-1 though, in college, if it's not the last quarter and you got a really smart team you're playing against, which isn't always the case, but they can also see the ball go through the net, slowly take it out of bounds, and really blow your 2-for-1 in a hurry. And hopefully people know what I'm talking about. If we've scored and there's 40 seconds to go and we think there's going to be 10 seconds, even if our opponent uses all 30 seconds, but if they slowly take the ball out of bounds and run 4, 5, 6 seconds off before they inbound it, I will tell you, Bill Fenley will do that every time at Iowa State. It'll blow your 2-for-1 in a hurry. So you have to understand that it's not as obvious at times. Because if you play someone like that and you take a quick shot and you maybe don't take a great shot, now you've eliminated that advantage. So understanding that every advantage at the pros is not the same advantage in the college game, but certainly something that we teach. We just call it 21. Not shocking. It's not like we're going to just get in a quick drag or a quick step up and try to go score. Now we may spray it out. If we don't get a shot, we're going to play out the possession, but we do understand and teach to those 2-for-1 concepts.
That's fascinating. Is there a number that generally, a number range which works for a 21 for you guys?
Yeah, I think anytime you get, if you inbound the ball and you're between 50 and 45, I think you go. I think those to me, I think at the collegiate women's game, if you can get the ball back and you can have 10 to 12 seconds, you're in a pretty good position to do something. I think anything when you start to get under 7, it might be a waste. Like it might be a, hey, we should have worked to get a better shot. If this is what we're going to end up with, a heave on that last possession. So I think the safe one is if I see 50, we're for sure 2-for-1.
I love you highlighting the difference because there's definitely still a difference between obviously the pro and the college game and between the men's and the women's game and all this other stuff, which that's a different story, different conversation. But the other thing you highlighted is the fact that sometimes players shoot a better percentage at that time because they know they're shooting. And a lot of the numbers that I've seen from the NBA people that I know suggest that's actually true, that they shoot a higher percentage, even though it might be a tougher shot, like in a one-on-one situation, because there's no thought to anything other than
No
shooting.
thought. All players are at their best. You ask players, when are you in your zone? It's when I'm not thinking. How do you get to that space? Most of them don't know how they get to that space where they're not thinking, but certainly our goal, and it's a lot of what I try to do in how I teach the game at this level is, okay, I want to teach you to play, not run plays. So I want you to, we're going to spend as much time in secondary action and break it into threes and fours in a practice setting. In the summer, we're in twos and threes all the time because to me, the game's either a two-player action or a three-player action. And we have to understand those reads and where the help side is at and who's tagging the roller. And so there's all these concepts that we're teaching that I think we teach as well as anyone in the country. And I think it's because of the pro aspect. I want to teach them to play in drags, to play in step ups, to play in pistols, to play in wide pin downs. And like, we don't have to. I'm going to look each year, what is our team good at? This past year, we were really good in a 5-2, 5-3 pin down action. It could be wide, it could be maybe shorted, but ultimately, like, this team, I knew. So the only creativity I have to have is what are a bunch of different ways I can up screen into a catch, I can loop into a catch, into a pin down, I can drag into a pin down, I can horns, and now maybe my passer is different or I've moved people around. And then especially at our level, because we don't have a defensive three, now I have to be creative about, do I have someone in on the floor that's not an elite spacer? How do I occupy their defender so that their defender can't help? But this year's team was great at read curl. We curl, we catch, we drop it to our post who's screening and running to the rim. Like, it's okay, they're going underneath. We bounce it back, we shoot it. We could post feed, we could play to pitch. So for us, I want them to understand all of those dynamics more than I want them to get in a box set, in a 1-4 set, in a horn set, in a, are we going to run plays and try to take advantage of mismatches? Yes, but like, how simple can I make the game for them so that they just get to play and make reads? And we're not perfect. And, but I think when you look at our analytics, when you look at our assist percentage, when you look at what we're trying to get to, we get balanced scoring. We're not dominant necessarily in any one action. We're just going to set a lot of ball screens. We were terrible in flares this year, so we didn't set a lot of flares. So you're figuring out each year, what am I going to be great at? And then how do I utilize this group in those actions?
I love that. And I enjoyed watching your team play. Very conceptual with the approach, it seemed, and really simple in the concepts, which maybe we'll talk about a little bit more at the end.
Hey, coach, a brief timeout from the podcast to bring you the Analytics Minute, sponsored by Hoopsalytics. If you watch a lot of basketball game video like we do, you always see things you'd like to remember or share. Being able to capture, organize, retrieve, and share plays, sets, and actions with a playbook for your coaching staff and players will make your teams and overall programs that much better. Hoopsalytics now includes an integrated playbook organizer that can do the following for you. Add plays, including text descriptions, diagrams, other images, and videos from just about anywhere. Link to real-life examples of these plays from your game videos. Categorize playbook entries as plays, actions, drills, moves, and other categories. Add attributes for different entries like man, zone, needed to, etc. Star entries to feature for a team like things to learn before a practice. Hoopsalytics brings the most powerful analytics to teams of all levels. It's easy to use and affordable. It's like AI for basketball coaches. Visit hoopsalytics.com/ball today. That's hoopsalytics.com/ball today to learn more and start analyzing your games for free.
Maybe another special situation for me, foul or defend up three. I'm not sure your thoughts on that. You can go either way and be right, and you can go either way and be wrong, obviously. Not just that, but more so, I'd like your thoughts on general and fouling at the end of games, because I'm seeing that sometimes, like coaches trying to play it out a little bit longer to try and get a steal, get a deflection versus fouling right away and stopping the clock and having more time to be able to counter.
Yeah, I think you have to know your team. Going back to, do I foul up three? My philosophy would be under eight, we're gonna really think about that, right? Like, that eight is that magic number to me, but also then, but that magic number may stop at three because at three, and then you have to understand your team well enough. Can they execute fouling someone? And so my philosophy is, okay, are they moving away from the basket or towards the basket? Because if they're moving away from the basket, I can foul. If they're moving towards the basket, I probably shouldn't foul. True story, end of game situation, way too much pro in me, not enough college at the time. We're playing Kansas State a year ago. We're at home. We're down three. And I call timeout. We advance. I've got a play set up to make a three. Okay, there's not an exact time here. I don't remember it exactly, but Kansas State has three fouls to give. I know they're going to take fouls. As most people are going to understand the terminology, we're zipping our point guard to the top to get a catch, inbound it. And I had told her, I said, now, if you turn and they foul you and they just reach across your arms, act like you're shooting and throw it at the basket. Now, I'm telling you this, but I promise you I had a play set up for Sarah Andrews to get a three off an elevator with a secondary action if that didn't work. And so what happens? They do a good job. They immediately foul her as she's going away from the basket. So no opportunity to turn, no opportunity to shoot it. So we haven't even gotten to the point where we've run anything, they've seen anything. I don't need to call another timeout. And so we zip her to the top again. And boy, she turns and shoots it before the kid ever even has a chance to foul her.
Oh
And
no.
I'm telling you, throws it at the basket, 28 feet from the basket, and everyone in the arena is, whoa, what just happened? And it was like we're learning lessons as coaches at every point in our career. And that play that you see a Chris Paul, a Steph Curry, a Skylar Diggins make where they just feel that arm across their wrist. And I know they've changed the rules in the NBA about what's a shooting foul, what's not. But I took an opportunity away from my team to run a play and potentially tie the game because I was overthinking. I was trying to be smarter and probably didn't understand my team enough to know how she would react in that pressure situation. And when it comes to fouling, like we are going to use our fouls when we can. We were playing Virginia Tech. We were up four late in the game. We had one foul to give. They don't have a timeout. It's perfect time to use it. Now they've got something called. You disrupt what they had to call. Now they got to take it out on the side and they've got two seconds and Georgia Amore has to throw something up over her shoulder. So I firmly believe in late game fouling when you can to disrupt, to screw up people's timing. But I also just don't want, I've seen too many people get clean looks and score. Now, at the same time, if you have a terrible rebounding team, we were top 10 in the country in rebounding this year. So I'm not worried on a free throw about our ability to rebound if I foul on a, and because that's what you always have to think about. If I'm going to foul up three, they make the first, they've got to miss the second. Now they have to get the offensive rebound. Now they have to score. You have all these scenarios in play that have to all go right. But if you're not an elite rebounding team, I'm not sure I would take that chance. If you're a good in your face, I'm not going to give you a shot. We don't have that many players in the collegiate women's game that can just elevate over the top and make a three and beat you. So there's that give and take of understanding your team, understanding your opponent, and maybe it's not a one size fits all. It could be opponent driven, it could be your own team.
So many things I'm thinking, but I want to go into the timeout since you referenced that. How much has your timeout philosophy changed over time, especially from your first collegiate to your WNBA to now back to college? Particularly, I don't think it happens as much in the women's game, but it's still a curiosity. I was growing up in FIBA a little bit more, but like the timeout after a score as a momentum play to stop your own momentum is
That's
still
yes,
curious.
I don't get it, but
You
I
don't
think I
get it.
don't get it because once it's taken out of your bag, like you go to the pros, you can't. There is no such
You
thing as
can't
taking
Phoebe, you
that
can't the
quote
pros.
defensive timeout. So I love it. I love it when my opponents do that because I feel exactly that way. Like, why didn't you call the timeout before the offensive possession and say, okay, here's what we're running when we score? We're going to jump in this press because I will tell you the whole quick timeout, defensive timeout, all that does is let me set up my press break. I know what you're doing. Like, we're all creatures of habit. I know what you like to do coming out of these defensive timeouts. Now I'm going to burn you with a home run ball, or you're going to have to foul me anyway. And now you've used your timeout. Now you might not be able to advance when you need to advance. And I think that's like, when you talk about what did I learn in the pros, the beauty of the pros is that if you're playing four games a week, which is pretty average, three to four games, two to three of those four are going to be time and score driven. Like you might get up 16, but if you watch the majority of WNBA games, the lead's going to get cut to six or eight. It may not get to one possession game, but you're going to have to manage your team. You're going to have to manage the clock, and you're going to be put in those situations. When you look at the average margin of victory for P4 teams over the course of the season, especially top 25 teams, and teams are winning by 20, 25, 35 points, they're not put in those positions to be in a lot of end of game situations. And I think that's you. anyone who knows my team is going to go, when Coach Nikki has the board in her hand, it's like her sandbox. This is when we get to play. And I live for those moments. I will, if we're in a tough road environment and I have to use a timeout in the second quarter to stop momentum, I'm going to do it. I'm not that stubborn, but I would border on the line of stubborn because I know the value of having them in those late game situations and the way you can extend a game and the way it matters. And we're going to play in enough close games that I want my players to be confident in those situations. And we're going to drill them in practice. And we have a 76 all game that we play where we put 76 all on the court. We could be playing against each other. We could be playing against our guys, but we're going to play with no clock till someone gets to 80. And it could be 80 to 76. It could be 81, 79. But once one team hits 80, we're going to stop and put 2 minutes on the clock. And the beauty of those 2 minutes is I have unlimited timeouts because why would I want to play that game and not have timeouts? But the whole point is to get them to learn to defend in late game situations. To our team really buys into it. And we probably don't do it as much as I would like at times because you do get in the grind of scouting opponents. What are we going to do? But I do think like your team learning to be confident and comfortable in those situations goes a long ways. You may just win because you have a better player in college. You may. You can get away with that. But I love when teams take defensive timeouts. And since I've come back to college, you probably don't know this, but I'm chair of the NCAA Rules Committee. So our conversations are always stemming. Like we've had people bring up, should we have defensive 3 seconds? I'm like, first of all, like it's all we can do over a 4-year period to get our kids to the midline. Like the last thing we need to be doing is teaching them to cleanse ball side or cleanse backside or tag a cutter, or we don't need officials having to have to call defensive 3 seconds and understand what that means. And so there are certain things that translate and certain things that don't. It's one of those where we're always talking about, do we align with college women's basketball more with the NBA, more with the WNBA, more with FIBA? And we've leaned more into the FIBA. We have leaned in more, but you also can't do everything. You can't just say, we're going to go to FIBA rules. But as our rules have changed, we've even moved to, hey, you turn it over in the backcourt this year, you get the ball back, we're going to put 20 seconds on the clock. Maybe it changes 5 possessions a game. Maybe that's which creates 3 more possessions because now you're at 20 instead of 30. So how are we continuing to drive offense? How are we also like, we want our game to look pretty. We want it to flow
Does
and
the 10
function.
set 10 count recount reset too?
No, you're already in the front
Oh,
court.
you're already in the
So
front card. Okay, my fault. Okay. Yeah,
So
fascinating. Wow, I love you being on that rules committee. That's got to be entertaining.
I think the thing about it is I thought I was on it as the new guy in the league. Like the Big 12 was looking for someone to take over a spot of a departing coach. And then by the end of the first meeting, it was, we want to name you chair of the committee. And then I'm like, okay, is this the new guy thing again? And then at the end of year one of being the chair, they're like, okay, we reelect a chair every year, but the whole duration you're on the committee, you can be the chair. So would you do it again? So I'm starting my 3rd year, but I do care about the rules and I would love to eliminate. You talk about that defensive timeout. Like, I think you have the ability if you're talking to your team on offense is what we're going to run. I think there's the element of surprise that matters more. It doesn't mean in that timeout, I'm not telling my team if they score, I would expect them to press. But now you're asking them to do it live. You're asking them to remember and get to their spots and not have game slippage. When you get to walk them out and say, go to these spots, like fake like you're going to screen and fly, all of those things, it's very easy. It's the biggest difference to me between college athletes and pro athletes is if I have a timeout and I can put a play up on a board and and immediately we're on offense, I will guarantee you my team is going to execute and score or get a great shot. If we're on defense, it is 60-40 whether that play is going to be run the way I drew it up. There's that game slippage of, or what if we get a stop? We're in transition. I don't want to slow up. So now we're in a dead ball and we're 3 possessions later. Where was I supposed to be? What was I supposed to do? So
Does
you have
practice
much.
that?
We do, but I
Yeah.
still think you're
I understand
so.
why they struggle with
Yeah,
it.
they lose track of, okay, where if they know I can walk out and I'm supposed to start on the right elbow, because the one thing about me, and then you can watch any of our film and say, okay, I mean, It would probably be annoying as an opponent to be like, okay, do I have to draw that play up for the scouting report too? Because it's not something we've ever run. Like most timeouts are something we have not run. Now they might be a counter to what we've run. They might be something I've been waiting to put in and now's the opportunity. It's not going to be, I can't just say, hey, we're in loop down. And so where their mind goes, yep. And I'm not super creative with play calls. I'm not trying to fool anybody. I'm not, we are telling them the action and what they're doing in it. So if it's loop and we're gonna loop, and if it's down, it's gonna be a down screen. Like I am not trying to fool anybody, including my opponents. You still have to guard it. You still have to top block. You have to lock and trail. You have, what are you gonna do? We need to be prepared to be able to execute at whatever defensive coverage is out there. And if you got a hand signal for everything, our kids are gonna, we're gonna know what your call is. But it doesn't mean we don't still get hit on the back screen. It's just the reality is, hey, it's the back screen play, it's the Spain action, and they're still gonna mess it up.
Yeah,
Like it just happens.
it just speaks to what you just said, which is diagramming the play. We're on defense first, and then we're on offense. And a lot of that is memory recall stuff, but most of it's related to experience, right? Like
Correct.
just a pro seeing
Absolutely.
so much more that they have this
And
chunking
the
ability.
pros, it's like they've seen that action before. They're gonna dial back to something. Like I've had pros like basically get traded mid-year. You can throw them into a game and be like, okay, your loop five is our loop down. When you can tell them on the fly and they can do it. Like you can watch people mid-season jump in and play, and you're not like, how does she know what they're doing already? We're all like doing some variation of the same things. Everybody's in flow, everybody's in delay, everybody, like, what are those actions? And so now, do people teach it differently? Do they have different options? Do they have better options in different positions? Sure. But the reality is, if you look at how teams flow, it's all going to look pretty similar in
That's
the pros,
amazing.
anyway.
Yeah, it's just amazing to talk to a pro and even get their insights into the little details like that because they've just experienced so much more. Absolutely beautiful. You mentioned something that I want to dive into because we're seeing this in the NBA playoffs in particular. This ability to be able to maintain a lead or obviously take back a lead in the sense when you're down. So let's start with the first situation. My team is beating your team. We're up 20. Let's say we're going into midway through the third quarter. So what are you telling your team? How are you telling your team to manage that moment?
Possession. It's a possession game. It's you can't get everything back at once. You got down 20 by them being elite possession by possession. Okay, to me, I'm just a big believer in, I'm not saying I'm not a raw coach. I will cheer on my team. Sometimes they need that more than they need X's and O's, but most of the time for us, we're very businesslike when it comes to timeouts in game. We're talking about what adjustments do we need to make, what's working. Hey, right now we need to be in more step ups than drags. Here's why we need to be more focused on an early post entry. Okay, where's the help coming from? I tend to ask the team in most games, what are they doing with our ball screens? Okay, if you don't know, then how are we going to exploit what they're doing? And so it's very much possession. We're just talking about possessions at that point. We got to get a stop. We got to get a score. We need them to call the next timeout. Like that's the challenge. We need them to call, like, we need to be on the next run. Doesn't have to be an 18-0 run, but it needs to be a 6-0 run. We need to make them think that because the reality is teams that get ahead by a lot oftentimes get comfortable. And no matter how much you coach against that, it happens. It becomes too easy.
Human
Perfect
nature.
example, we're at Arizona this past year. We are rolling. They can't guard our middle ball screen actions. We're hitting threes. We're getting whatever we want. And we get comfortable. And now everyone feels like it's my turn to take a shot. And we're not necessarily being selfish. We miss a couple open shots that we had just made. And the next thing you know, they're scoring. Now they're pressing. Now, like, those things start to change. The energy of the game changes, the crowd changes. And so, you by nature, humans get comfortable when things are easy.
I remember the exact moment in my coaching career that this happened, where I was smart enough to run the same play over and over again because it was working and not
Correct.
outthinking myself as a coach going, oh, I got to be more creative or I got to show more stuff or anything like that. No, and it was just an action, a simple flex screen that a team had a hard time covering, a simple flex screen action. And we just kept running it and running it. And I remember that exact moment in my career. And that's a hard step for young coaches in particular to get to, isn't
It's
it?
a hard, my first year here, we were playing Oklahoma and we had played them twice. Both games were one possession games. We had lost. We're playing them in the Big 12 tournament and they played us a lot of matchup zone. And I was trying to get in the list of the ball on the block. They were doing a good job showing help. We just started running horns and playing high low, getting her the ball in the middle of the floor. And she was just owning. I think she had 37 in that game. And it's already okay. They've beaten us twice in the regular season. We won the league, but we're not getting beat by Oklahoma three times. And I remember telling the girls at halftime, like, hey, don't get bored until they make an adjustment. We're not making an adjustment right here. It's working. And so that was until they got out of their zone because they absolutely didn't make the, they just stayed single coverage. And Alyssa just kept going to work. And then Queen got going. And then our backup post was playing well. And so you can. And I kept telling them that. And everyone knows me. We all have tendencies as coaches. So I've always been this way. Like, I'm not afraid to talk. I'm sure at times my administration, my staff is like, why are you telling people that in the press conference? It's just, I'm like, if they're not doing their homework and watching the games, they're gonna. And I wasn't necessarily this way this year. But my tendency, we may not run a lot of horns, but when I had Melissa and Queen and Caitlin Bickles, so I had three pros that could play in the middle of the floor, we may have run horns three times through three quarters. But if we were up eight with 6 minutes to go, we were probably going to go to our horns package. We were probably going to play through the middle of the floor. Everyone slows down. We control the clock. It was our clock controlling offense. Not that it's fast or slow. It's just that idea of, okay, we're going to get in horns. We're going to look in the post. If we don't, we'll swing it. We'll get into a ball screen. But that was our, what I did. And in this year's team, I would tell you, like, it was middle ball screen, roll and rise. Like, we played to that, our five up, our four down. If I really didn't feel good about our four being down, I'd put my two down, rise my two, and play high low with my two. And we got really good at playing in the middle of the floor that way. So we may run a ton of slot and wing ball screens throughout the course of the game, but when we get in late game and I want to control and have true control, the ball's going to be in my point guard's hands and we're going to play in that middle third of the floor. And if I'm giving up something, then you haven't watched film because I'm not telling you anything that if you watch us, you're not going to see. And that's because that's what this team was better at. Because now you have to make a decision with this year's team. You had to make a decision on with X4. Are you going to help on the roll? Are you going to? And so you couldn't make that in horn sometimes, depending on who's up there. Are they in that denial? Do they do a good job with a corner player showing the tag from the corner player? And now I'm asking my point guard to throw the cross court skip. I don't want to put them in that position. I had a little point guard. Knowing your team, if people took away that high post pass, or I don't have the passer there that I need there, then I've got to adapt. And so that's what I think we're talking a lot about, that adaptation of pro to college. It's that's where I think my growth came. I've worked for great coaches. My husband was a good middle ball screen coach. Carl Semesco was a great motion coach. It was spacing driven. It was double gaps. It's been super fun to see him take what he did and add it to what they do, while at the same time, he's running a lot of horns. He's running a lot of horns
He's
action.
playing
So
different. He's playing a little
he's playing
different.
different. He has to, but I will tell you, I went to their training camp and got to watch him a day. And the beauty of it was he hasn't changed. And that's what I love. Even though it's been for, I don't know, 8 years since I worked, 9 years since I worked for him, how he communicates, his sarcasm, like he hasn't really changed. And that to me makes him special. And so it was great to see the BGs and the Alicia Grays and those Ryan Howard, like, really listen. And it was just really cool for me to see, because it's not that I ever question, is he smart enough? Can he adapt? Like, the guy's a genius, but
Absolutely.
it was like, how are those 22 to 35-year-old pros going to see him? And so that was really cool for me because I just think he's incredible.
I imagine how he comes across, at least in all the conversations I've had with him, or conversations with people like you that know him, is all he's trying to do is put you in the best situation to be successful. And that's largely whatever he runs is more, it's more about the matchup than what he's actually running.
And I think I always say this to players because I think we run into this terminology a lot, especially in college. I'm not saying it doesn't happen in the pros too, but I don't want to be boxed in. I want to be able to play my game. Okay. This is what I tell people. The only box that you're in is the box that you've created for yourself. My job becomes easier the more things you can do, the more capable of you are at different places on the floor. So I don't want to box you in. But what am I trying to do? I'm trying to maximize what you do best and minimize what you're not good at. So I am, my goal all the time is to put everybody in the best, give them the best chance to be successful individually, which then collectively gives us the best chance to be successful. As much as analytics are really important, I'm still a believer in if you're a good jump shooter, like you need to take a jump shot. Like you, no one can tell me that a big part of UConn's success in winning a national championship this past year and what South Carolina couldn't guard pitched to a jump shot for AZ and Page. They pitched it, they ran and got it, they played to pull up against drop coverage. And they just got separation. And so in the midst of, is that a good shot? Is it not a good shot analytically? Sometimes it's a shot you got to take and make. And if you've got players who can take and make it, then you should let them take it. But at the same time, do I want kids that are bad at mid-range jump shots to be shooting mid-range jump shots? Absolutely not. Pass the ball. Like it's that simple. So you can you do a great job of getting them to buy into how you're trying to help them. And if there's something they're not good at, what are we doing to work on it? You want to shoot more threes? Okay. How are you going to go from a 25% shooter to a 30% shooter? I'm going to let a kid shoot threes if they make 30% of them. Do I want them to take six a game? No. But will I let them take three? Yes, because it may create opportunity for everybody else. And I think that's something Carl believed he could make everybody a 40% 3-point shooter. I did never saw that happen when I was there. But what I saw was him be able to take a kid whose shot didn't look like they could shoot and make 30% of them and make you question as a defender, do I guard them? Do I not guard them? And then you play off them because of the statistics, and then they burn you on a late game situation because you're playing the statistics. She's a better driver than shooter, but there's a confidence. Look at Bree Jones, how many threes she's taken for Carl already. That's going to change the dynamic of her and BG being able to play effectively together offensively. Is if you sink in off of one and BG can knock down a three, are they going to knock down three a game? Probably not. But can they make one a game and impact the spacing? I think they can. Ryan Howard's shooting horrible this season. You think people are going to stop guarding her? They're not going to stop guarding her because your analytics are still not just defined by recency bias. They're defined by career. And you're talking about one of the best 3-point shooters in the league and is always going to be high volume. So are you going to give her that shot? Because you give her one, she makes one. It could be five before you know it. So yeah, I think there's a lot of gray to me still, as much as we all look at analytics and play the analytic game. You have to play the game itself too.
The only people that absolutely know are TV analysts, obviously. So they
Right.
always know. But otherwise,
Right.
yes, there's not a lot of
Yeah.
absolutes. So many fascinating things here. I just want you to close the loop. We talked about when you're behind, but when you're up, same thing for you. Possession game. What are some things you're talking to your team about? The other team makes a run. What are some things?
Yeah, I think it's understanding the possession game. I don't think we want to start stalling. I don't think if you start playing to not lose instead of to win, your team gets tight. But it's also you really got to get your point guards dialed into, okay, we've taken quick shots, we've made quick shots to get this lead, but if we miss three shots in a row, let's slow down. Let's get the ball to our this year it would have been us getting the ball to Erinette Vonleh. Let's get a piece of the paint with her right now. I'm a big paint person anyway. If we haven't touched the paint three possessions in a row, I'm probably calling timeout anyway because I'm just not a believer in we're going to throw it ahead and shoot threes. We will attack and kick and shoot threes all day, every day. But our analytics say we're going to shoot 20 points higher with a paint touch than without. We know, like, we have those to me are like our absolutes. We're going to go back and say, did we get a piece of the paint? And you don't want them to start to question whether they should take open shots. But I think your team has to know who do we need to play to and through right now? Like, how do we have to stop a run? And I think it's there. I think that's, each team has to know. If you've got an Alyssa Smith, it's Alyssa Smith. If you have an Erinette Vonleh, it's Erinette Vonleh. But it might be Sarah Andrews in a ball screen and you're in a two-man game because they haven't been able to guard an empty side. And so I think it's when you play free and you get big leads, you can get away from some of the things that you know you're good at and can stick to. So it's about going back to those things.
Coach, this has been amazing. I could talk basketball with you all day and just hear your thoughts and your stories and your experiences. And thank you so much for sharing. And man, how fun to watch you coach at Baylor. We've enjoyed watching a number of your games this year. You must be loving it.
I do love it. This last season was a really awesome group. Really hard to see the season end, but excited what we were able to do in the portal and incoming freshmen. So excited to continue to build our own brand of basketball and continue the winning ways here.
And incredible facilities. I can see it behind you there. And man, some of the best in the world.
Yeah, that's the beauty. Foster Pavilion, the Allison Development Center. We really don't lack for anything here when it comes to facilities, resources, the things that we need to be great.
You're amazing. Thank you so much for sharing with us. And we can't wait to watch you compete next year. Thanks,
All
Coach.
right. Thanks.